Welcome to episode 254 of the Ski Podcast, and thanks for joining us, listener. We have a jam-packed episode for you today. We're going to be catching up on the latest news from La Plan, including new lifts and what it was like when the Tour de France came to town. We're going to look at what it's like in neighbouring Les Arcs in summer, and we're going to be finding out about the Flocon Vert, the sustainability award for ski resorts in France. There's snow reports from Australia and New Zealand, as well as a special report on the new Soho Basin ski area in Cardrona from Ski Sunday's Ed Lee. And finally, we have a lot of your feedback on our recent Blade and Lines episode. So that is a lot to cover. Let's get going and meet my guest today. Firstly, regular listeners will know her voice from her snow reports this winter. She's back for her, what I make to be her fifth time in the studio. La Plan expert, Jen Sang. Hi, Jen. How are you?
Hi, Ian. Yeah, I'm great. It's really, really nice to be back.
And my next guest joins us for her first time on the show. I'm delighted to welcome Claire Tollis from the Mountain Riders Association in France. Bonjour, Claire. How are you?
Hi. Very well. Thank you for inviting me.
It's a pleasure. Whereabouts are you today, Claire?
Somewhere in Ardèche, very low mountains.
Okay. Well, mountains are all over France. I'm going to come on to your role with Mountain Riders a little bit later on. But a question I always like to ask my guests to start off with is, when were you skiing or snowboarding last? And Jen, you live in La Plan, so my guess is it was in La Plan, but you tell me.
No, actually, I wasn't in La Plan, which is shocking, I know. But I actually spent the closing weekend of last winter in Val Thorens with Snow Camp doing their big charity event, the Three Valley Rally. And so I was over there doing some social media support and working with them. And it's a truly incredible event. So I was really, really honoured, very lucky to be there. And it was a fantastic few days. We'd had fresh snow, I think, a couple of days beforehand, and then glorious blue skies for the actual event. And I think it was like the very, very end of April, like the last weekend of April. So it really was fantastic. It was a good reason to leave La Plan.
Well, if any of our listeners listen to episode 249, they'll know a little bit more about the snow camp challenge. Claire, what about yourself? When were you last on snow?
I think it was that for Christmas, and I was in Lons-en-Vercors, which is a very small family resort. And my son is actually learning how to ski. And so he's 10 years old. And so I think that's the last time I put on skis, yes.
Okay. Now, I must admit, I'm a ski journalist. I've been working in the industry for a while. I can't quite place that immediately. Whereabouts is that resort?
That's 20 minutes from Grenoble. It's very close to Grenoble, and it's very low in altitude, but they had a load of snow for Christmas, so it was pretty nice to start learning skiing there.
And I think we might come on to that a little bit later on, because it's kind of pertinent to the work that mountain riders do, because smaller resorts like this that don't rely on international tourism such as La Plan, for example, but rely on locals who are going to them, are more at threat from global warming and climate change. But I think we'll leave that conversation for a little bit later on. There is actually a lot of skiing going on in the world right now. Not so much in Europe. There are just three glaciers open in the Alps at the moment, in Zermatt, Sesfay and Passo Stelvio. But down under, so let's hear from Miss Snow It All, Rachel Oakes-Ash from snowbest.com, for the latest snow news in Australia, and Guy Beetson in New Zealand.
Thanks, Ian. We're heading into the last week or so of winter down under, with spring officially here on September 1. Aussie resorts have had a great winter with a series of snowstorms, almost weekly, sometimes fortnightly, but it's been consistent, and that's what we really needed this year. Parrish's natural base is sitting at 160 centimetres with snowmaking on top of that, and Thredbo's calling over 2 metres of snowfall thus far. Now, down further south in Victoria, Hotham is zeroing in on 3 metres of snowfall, and all they need is another 10 to 15 centimetres to get there, and we reckon they'll get there by September 1. There's the pitter-patter of some rain coming in tomorrow, for New South Wales at least. Let's hope not, but there will be another snowstorm cycle come through by the end of next week. New Zealand hasn't been as lucky this winter. Well, it depends on where you are, really. Mount Hutt has had over 3.5 metres of snowfall this season so far, but nearby club fields haven't been as lucky, with Craigieburn and Temple Basin, Broken River, etc., all scratching for snow. In Mackenzie, Mount Dobson and Roundhill have also fared well, but down in Queenstown, they've been counting their snow making investment blessings this season, as Ulla has not been kind. However, traditionally, New Zealand always gets the latest snow and the big storms come through in September. That's what happened last year and we're hoping that happens again. In fact, we're counting on it. Meanwhile, on the North Island, Whakapapa and Tauroa at Mount Ruapehu have had 50 centimetres in the last week, so they're all pretty happy. Right now, all the international riders and skiers are hitting up Thredbo's stomping grounds, Parrish's Slopestyle Park and Cardrona's training terrain to get themselves in primo condition before the Olympic qualifying FIS World Cup season ahead. So expect to share a chairlift with the likes of Scotty James, Valentino Caselli, Jakara Anthony and their overseas friends.
Checking in from the Southern Hemisphere, here's what's happening on the snow in New Zealand right now. I spent a day up at Mount Dobson in the South Island, which currently has some of the best cover in the country. Hard-packed, well-groomed snow, all lifts running, and plenty of terrain open. A great place for carving turns and wide open spaces. Cadrona and Treble Cone are both in decent shape too. Cadrona has had some handy top-ups recently and remains a reliable option, while Treble Cone's upper mountain is skiing beautifully with plenty of off-piste for those who want to stretch the legs. I'll be heading to both in the coming days. Looking north, Whakapapa on Mount Ruapehu is operating with limited lifts, but snowmaking and natural falls are keeping the main trails open. Also on Mount Ruapehu, Tauroa is offering similar conditions, patchy in places but rideable, especially for locals chasing quick turns. Elsewhere, Coronet Peak and the Remarkables near Queenstown are holding steady. And finally, Mount Hutt continues to deliver. It's had regular top-ups through August and is shaping up for a strong late season. A real standout this winter. Looking ahead, many forecasts show more snow is likely across Mount Dobson, Mount Hutt, Treble Cone, and Ruapehu over the next week, with a few solid pulses likely in September. That should set us up nicely for spring skiing, and in my case, the Scout National Snow School at Whakapapa in mid-September with 24 Scouts and Venturers. That's the view from New Zealand, a mixed bag, but with some real highlights and more snow on the way.
If you listen to my interview with Ed Lee in episode 236, you'll know his home is in Wanaka in New Zealand. Rachel told us in episode 250 about the new Soho Basin ski area at Cardrona, and Ed has now had the chance to ride it. So let's hear what he thought of it.
So Cardrona have opened up Soho Basin, and it's a beautiful bit of terrain. I reckon you could argue the 150-odd hectares that it's opened up on the back of the resort, almost, it feels like it's doubled the skiable terrain in the resort. And while there's only really two pistes down there, there's a vast amount of off-piste that you can get stuck into. It's quite rocky, so it takes a bit of time to fill in. They don't have the same snowmaking infrastructure back there yet. So it's taken up until now to fill in a lot of the low tide rocks, but the terrain is adventurous, it's playful, and it gives you a huge amount of access to even more backcountry touring. So it is a vast improvement on the resort. I went down there with my wife as soon as they opened it up, and she said, this doesn't feel like Cadrona. And I think there's a strong argument to say that it doesn't really feel like New Zealand either. It's taken the resort from, I think, sort of that medium size resort into the big leagues. And it's the first one in the Southern Hemisphere that's really stretching like this. It is officially the biggest resort in the Southern Hemisphere, and that's a matter of pride for Cadrona. But it's also a massive feather in the cap of New Zealand, who are battling the Australian resorts, the Chilean and the Argentinian resorts. But it feels now that with consolidated growth over the last decade, you're starting to see a lot of investment in infrastructure down in New Zealand. The skiing there is a big deal. So Cadrona really stretching, and they're not in super resort status yet, but it is a big step up beautiful modern six-seater chair down there. So it's fast and vast, I think is the best way to put it. Definitely worth a visit.
So we haven't quite started up winter yet in Europe, but I know people are booking their holidays. So if you want to help the Ski Podcast and save yourself some money on a ski hire this winter, you can just use the code Ski Podcast when you book at insportrent.com. And that applies to any ski hire booked in their network across France, Austria and Switzerland. You'll get a guaranteed additional discount, or you can take the link in the show notes for your discount to be automatically applied. Now, it is still summer in Europe. It's the middle of August as we speak, and we're going to be focusing on that next. But last month, the Tour de France had stages that finished in Courchevel and La Plan. And before we come to you, Jen, find out what it was like in La Plan, let's hear from regular reporter Alex Irwin, who was in Courchevel for Stage 18.
Hi, Ian. Alex from 150 Days of Winter with a Tour de France report from Courchevel. For the third time in 5 years, Courchevel hosted the ending of a stage of the Tour de France, finishing at the Col de la Loze, one of the highest cols in France. If, like me, you aren't a closet Lance Armstrong, by which I mean a hardcore cyclist and not a pharmaceutically enhanced athlete, the thought of heading up a mountain to cheer on a bunch of cyclists you've never heard of is the furthest from my mind. But the Tour de France is way more than that. I think I could divide the day into the following. The first is cheering on the thousands of cyclists who head up the course throughout the day and realise it's a lot harder than you think. This is made much easier when you down a bottle of Prosecco and a tube of Pringles for that balanced lunch. Then there is the caravan, a procession of sponsored vehicles who hand out product to the spectators. My personal favourites are a supermarket chain who has two people driving around France in a melon and a strawberry-covered quad, slightly beating out the giant globe bottle of Orangina on wheels. Finally, after all that, the competition cyclists that have just spent 5 hours on a mountain stage, and in this case, the moment they arrived, it started to rain. Rain some more, and finally hail a bit. But despite all this, it was a great day. An Australian who I'd never heard of won the stage. He rode for a team that I'd never heard of either. But despite that, it was maybe worthy of the small fortune that resorts have to pay to host a finish.
So the following day was Stage 19. And weirdly, they kind of went back on themselves from Courchevel to Albeville. And then they went up to La Plan. And you were there that day, Jen, is that right?
Absolutely. We were here. Yeah, it's really a very awesome, very incredible thing to witness. I'm not a road cycling person or particularly a fan, so it's very new or very much a sport I don't follow, but it's still something that's really, really quite incredible to witness. I've been very lucky to see the tour zip by a few times in the past. I worked one summer in Corsica, and the tour started at the foot of Corsica one year and came right past the hotel that I was working at, and that was amazing. And so to see the finish line this year in La Plan was really awesome.
Oh, so I guess that was going to be my next question. Where did you place yourself? Because, you know, when the Tour de France comes by, like yourself, the Tour has passed me. And it's very different when the Tour passes you in a flat area, because basically you get a massive peloton and they all zoom past. You might have a few riders at the beginning, but typically I've been in Courchevel for a stage finisher before and they're spread out. So you get more value for money, to my mind. So where were you placed when the Tour came?
So for people who know La Plan, the finish line was in Plan Village. It was very busy up there, and the only way to access it was to walk up on foot, because the small bubble lift that was servicing it was just for people who were working up there and the volunteers and things. And I've got three small children that I was taking around to watch it. So we opted to stay in Plan Centre, which was like the final kind of like little village that they came through before the finish line. And we had kind of a roundabout that they circled round and headed up. So there was a really nice wide viewing point. So we stationed ourselves there, and it's actually ideal because it was where a lot of the caravan with all of the free things were being kind of focused and based. So there was a really great festival atmosphere. And to be very honest, that's all my kids were interested in. My kids are all under 10 and they just wanted as many free bucket hats as they could get. They were not so bothered about the road biking and the race coming through.
In terms of, you know, someone's never listening to this and they've never been to the Tour de France before, I think that one of the things that perhaps you wouldn't understand is the build-up. You just have this extraordinarily long build-up to when the actual cyclists arrive. With you're talking about the caravan there. Do you want to give an idea of, you know, how that works?
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, honestly, for us in Le Plan, the build-up started weeks ago, because, or like weeks in advance of the event, because we also were really, really fortunate in Le Plan to have the Étape du Tour come up the week before, which is when all the when a lot of amateurs are able to race a stage of the actual Tour de France. And so we had the stage 19, Albertville to Le Plan, was chosen for the Étape 5 days before the actual Tour de France came through. So that was really, really incredible. So we had this huge Tour de France atmosphere and ambience in Le Plan for the entire week. And then also before that, because there was loads of motorhomes turning up beforehand with all their flags and their banners and stationing themselves all along the hairpins on the way up to Le Plan. So that was brilliant. And then on the actual day, the caravan coming through is all the sponsors of the tour coming through with all of their merchandising, essentially, and free branding and things like that. So this year, the theme was very much bucket hats. Was very on point with like Oasis touring the UK and things. So we are now the proud owners of bucket hats for Laughing Cow Cheese, Skoda, Leclerc, and many, many other French brands that I can't think of right now. But it's really, really good fun. And they are almost like a festival or a fair village fete that you would have in the UK with all the different floats coming through. So like Leclerc have their cars come through and they look like fruits. So there's an apple and then a melon and then something else comes through. You've got a pasta sponsor and they just throw big bags of pasta at you. So you've got to hope you catch it and it doesn't hit you. It's very, very fun. And then that does happen about an hour and a half before the actual races come through. So there is a bit of a pause in the middle.
You said, you know, the build-up was over a week because you had the Étape come through first. You are a resident of Le Plan. Do you see that as being disruption, you know, for locals? Was that problematic at all with everything going on in relation to the tour? Or is it more about the excitement of being a focal point?
I mean, I think it's a little bit of both, but the excitement very much outweighs the, I say, quote unquote, inconvenience. The only real inconvenience is just how busy it is and how little parking there is when there's so many people in the resort. But the actual organisation of the event was incredible. Considering there were 16,000 riders came up into Le Plan on the Étape du Tour, it just didn't feel overwhelmed. It felt very efficient, very smooth. The atmosphere was just buzzing, like very, very positive. And the feedback seems to have been very similar when I've spoken to local businesses or people who were here on holiday to experience it. Yeah, of course, it can be difficult when there's lots of people in town, but it was a minor inconvenience, really.
Sure. And, I can see how local businesses would benefit hugely because, you know, typically it's a relatively quiet time of year. And we'll talk about the Alps in summer. You know, not everywhere is Chamonix, which is jam-packed, you know, through the summer. So there's a big boost for tourism. And, you know, one of the reasons that destinations want to host stage finishes of the Tour de France is because of future tourism, because, you know, this will guarantee now that a lot of people will want to come and they'll want to cycle that climb in the future and there'll be a stream of tourists. But there's a cost attached to that, isn't there? And I know you're pretty well informed about affairs of Le Plan, but do you have any idea how much it costs the resort to be able to host that stage?
Honestly, no, I really don't know. What I can see is the benefits that have come into the resort with it that are going to be long term. So yes, the attraction of some summer tourism for us. We do have bike lifts open and mountain biking. We do see a lot of road bikers doing the climb up to Le Plan because it is challenging. And I think we will only see more of that in the summer. But things like the infrastructure getting improved for that event, like a lot of the roads got resurfaced, a lot of the signage around resorts, a lot of the painting and just the visuals of Le Plan got improved. as a local, I can only support all of that. It was really, really nice to see some money being put into the resort like that.
I mean, you mentioned Corsica. I was in Corsica on holiday last summer, and a couple of the roads there, I just like knew when you said the tour a bit, I knew there'd been some kind of cycle race there because they were in such good condition. It was unbelievable. You mentioned infrastructure. So, you know, while we have you on, you are an expert on La Plan. I wanted to ask you about a couple of new lifts, one of which is definitely happening and another which is proposed, if I understand it. And I'll ask you about that proposed one to start off with, because I read on your website, that's La Plan, about a possible new gondola that would run from M to La Plan. And I wondered if you could give us an insight into, you know, why that's being discussed and how likely it is that that will happen.
So this is something that's been in discussion for a long, 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 long time. I mean, I've lived in La Plan nearly 20 years now, and they've been discussing this for about 40 years. So it has been an ongoing long-term conversation. It always peaks and then it drops off. However, with the added impetus of the 2030 Winter Olympics being in France and La Plan hosting the bobsleigh portion of the Olympics, that seems to have really remotivated and reopened the conversations in a much more dynamic, much more structured way. And so it seems very, very positive, the conversation at the moment. I went down to the local meeting, which I think was in May or June, to hear the proposal from the Aim La Plan, Mary. It was very, very interesting. I've never seen so many people crammed into one small room for a town meeting. So it is a very, very popular topic.
Yeah. And, you know, for someone like myself, who typically travels by train to the Alps, would that lift kind of link up with the railway station in M as well? So we're kind of talking about a seamless form of transport to come by train and then take the gondola up to the Station of La Plan.
Yes, exactly. So it is a gondola rather than a funicular like you've got going from Bourg Saint-Maurice up to Les Arcs. We're looking at a gondola which would be from the Aim La Plan train station. It would come all the way up to La Plan. At the moment, a proposed mid station at La Roche. For those who know La Plan, La Roche is where the bobsleigh, the finish and the start of the bobsleigh, at the bottom and the top of La Roche. So the aim is to have a mid station there. And then the final point of the gondola to be in Plan Centre, where the Gare Routière is in at the moment, for that area to be extended with some underground tunnels and infrastructure to support the amount of people who will be coming into resort via that entranceway.
Oh, well, you know, I think that would be great. I've travelled by train to many resorts around Europe, and some of them, you know, when the connections are perfect, such as in Verbier, if you get off at Le Chable, you can get the gondola straight into the resort. Or there's another resort called Fischeralp in Switzerland, same sort of thing, the gondola leaves directly from the train station. Does make it easier, and evidently one of the ideas of this would be to take cars off the road as well, similar to the proposal for the lift from Bazel up to Courchevel. You know, not just for tourists, but also for all of the workers, because I imagine, I mean, I know you live up in resort, but I think a lot of people have probably been pushed down the valley as well.
Yes, exactly. So that's very much the angle that the proposal has taken, is that, yes, it is for tourism, but it is also something that they very much want to put in to support locals and people working here. So, for example, a lot of the people who work on the lifts and in the lift pass offices, ski instructors and things like that, unless they're seasonal, just coming in for the winter season, that people who live here kind of 12 months of the year are very much living in the valley, because it is very expensive to live at the top of the mountain in resort. It's very, very difficult for us to afford to buy property in a ski resort on hospitality wages. And so, yes, a lot of people are living in the valley and have to get buses up and down the mountain. And for example, it's happened in the past where there's been an accident on the road, or there's been a huge snowfall, or something has happened and the road access has been blocked and the lifts have been delayed opening because the seasonal workers cannot get up the mountain to open the lifts. I mean, that's very, very rare and has happened maybe once or twice in my memory. But, you know, things like this do happen. And so to be able to take that traffic off of the road and put it into the gondola for locals could be really, really interesting, especially on very, very busy weekends and Saturday transfer days, for example, when the roads are often gridlocked when you get into the valley. So being able to hop on a train that then connects to a gondola to bring you straight up to resort is really exciting news. And they are also working with SNCF, I think, to try and increase and improve the train network as well to then feed the resorts, because it's at the moment it's trying to motivate and convince more and more people to take the trains. But when they then struggle to be able to get up that final portion of the mountain, it can be quite difficult. So it's a big, big, big project, not just the gondola. There's so many moving parts.
Yeah, I mean, the final mile is often the issue. But I know the mayors and the communes of the Tarentaise have been working very closely with SNCF, and they do have a genuine policy to do something about it. So that's very interesting. You mentioned kind of traffic. Let's think about a different sort of traffic. There is one lift that is definitely, new lift that is definitely happening in the plan, and that is the Roche de Millau changes there. Perhaps you could just explain a little bit about where it goes from and to, but my understanding is it's to relieve a pressure point, because you can get some fairly big queues in Le Plan in peak season. Is that right?
So the old Roche de Millau gondola, as in the one that is now being replaced, used to go from Bellecote with a mid station in Belle Plan and then up to the Roche de Millau. The new lift will be starting in Bellecote, but it's taking a slightly different tour. So it's not that straight line through Bellecote up to Roche de Millau. It's now a bit of a dog's leg where it will stop at the Col de Forc, with a midpoint there where you can also get on, and then up to the Roche de Millau. So it changes the route slightly of the lift, and it's going to, I think, make it quicker to get from Bellecote up and out to the top of Roche de Millau. It's a bigger gondola, it's faster, it's high speed. So the traffic, the lift traffic is going to move quicker because of that. Having that midpoint at the Col de Forc, for those that know Le Plan, if you ski across from Plan Centre, from the top of Grand Rochette, if you ski down the Petit Rochette blue piece, the mid station is just at the bottom of that. So you'll be able to hop on there and head straight up to Roche de Millau instead of having to ski into Bellecote. So the idea is it should relieve some of that traffic coming into Bellecote. The only kind of, I wouldn't say it's a negative, but it's something to be seen, is that for those that are in Belle Plan, they now don't have a lift that is taking them up straight up to the peaks, up to the higher areas. People who are on holiday in Belle Plan are now going to have to drop down into Bellecote, whether they take that new lift or they take one of the other lifts from Bellecote to head elsewhere. So that's going to be interesting. And I'm waiting to see how that kind of pans out. But it seems like it has maybe, I don't want to sound negative, but it seems like it might have just isolated Belle Plan a little bit. So we'll have to see what happens up there, because it's the highest resort, it's the highest village in Le Plan. So it's a very, very popular place to stay. It's got some fantastic restaurants and it's very attractive in Le Plan, but the lift access is changing up a little bit. So let's see what happens there.
So it will open in December, right?
Yes, exactly. So it's open in December. It's being worked on at the moment. The gondolas are actually on the lift. I've seen them moving when I've been out and about walking this summer. So it's all on time is what I hear. Pedestrians used to be able to use the old gondola to go between Bellecote to Belle Plan as like a free shuttle bus service. So currently that's being run by a shuttle bus while the works are happening this summer. And then in the winter, pedestrians will be able to go between the two villages. So that is happening as well.
Oh, that's great. Thank you for that big Le Plan update covering the Tour de France and those new lifts. You mentioned that you were hiking it in the mountains, and I mentioned earlier, a couple of weeks ago, I was just across the valley from you in Les Arcs, and there were two reasons for that. I'm writing an article for Adventure Magazine, and I was taking part in a trail race, you know, relatively short one by some of the standards of what I've done. It's really a practice before an ultramarathon I've got coming up, well, next week now in Chamonix. I'll share that article when it's published, but I can tell you Les Arcs genuinely challenges Chamonix as an adventure capital in summer. It was kind of a surprise to me. It doesn't have those crowds that Chamonix can have, you know, in summer. You mentioned parking in the plan can be a problem. You know, parking in Chamonix can be impossible in summer. I was only there for a few days, but trail running, hiking, I did e-biking. Did a zip line, did mountain karting, went to a spa called the Nama Spring Spa, which a tourist office kindly organized for me. Those are just some of the things I did. Yeah, I think it's a really, really good destination for families. Yeah, because a lot of apartments that people can stay in there. And a lot of people were using a product they had called the Hero Pass. And it's a bit like your Lift Pass, I suppose, in winter. But it's a single pass that you can buy. And then it covers not just the lifts, but all of the different activities and the swimming pools, et cetera, as well. And so about €40 or so for a week. So a really good value. And in fact, in the mornings, it's a kind of a bit like winter in some respects, because you see all these families taking their kids to drop off. And instead of ski school, they're doing like hero camp, and they're all in different categories and they're all lining up. And, you know, the kids go off and do all these activities all over the mountain. And then the parents can go off and do their own activities, whatever it is that they want to do in the day till they, you know, they pick them up a bit later.
The family activities in the Alps are just incredible, and it really is stunning here. And I have friends here on holiday this week, and they have actually mapped out their days, mornings and afternoons. And we're only on Thursday, so yesterday we were whitewater rafting in the valley, which is amazing, on the Isere. Before that they were e-biking, before that they were doing the mountain karting, and they've still got two more days to go. I think we're doing some horse riding tomorrow. I think they're having a relax today and catching up with themselves. But yeah, it is fantastic. And Lazark is incredible for the mountain biking. And it is a lot quieter than some of the bigger resorts. And I think that's a huge bonus.
For sure. I mean, you mentioned the rafting. I've done that before while staying in Borg St. Maurice, and it's great fun going down the Isere. Did that with my kids when they were around the age of your kids just now. But you're right. I mean, there's so many activities. And I think one of the reasons I wanted to cover this is I'm not sure that everybody necessarily understands. They understand the Alps are about skiing in winter. They don't necessarily understand there's so many activities that you can do out there in the summer as well. You know, for me, it was about hiking and getting up into the mountains. And I'm sure many of our listeners will have heard this sound before, but this is one of my favorite mountain sounds. It was recorded en route to an overnight stay at Refuge du Mont Pourri. I wondered, Claire, have you ever stayed in a refuge up on the mountains before?
Sure, yeah, many times. Yeah, loving hiking, backpacking.
Whereabouts have you stayed in refuges?
Last time was in the Pyrenees, because I go there a lot. I'm from south of France, so these are my favorite mountains. Last time I was in a refuge, last week we were in La Vanoise National Park with my son. And so we spent a week wandering around hiking. And even one afternoon we were in a refuge, and there was a concert in the middle of the afternoon. It was very nice, like three musicians. They were hiking with their instruments and giving concerts every night in a different refuge. And so it was totally improvised, but it was really, really nice.
Yeah, well, that's brilliant. And, you know, the refuge I was in was on the edge of the Vanoise National Park. And listeners, you know, they've probably seen signs if they've skied around in the Tarentaise for the Vanoise National Park. But essentially, it's a big area that sits behind the three valleys, La Plan, Les Arcs, up to Tiene, Val d'Isère, going down south as well. And you can hike through it. There are some refuges in that area. And, you know, if you don't know a refuge, it's essentially like a mountain hut. It's a bit nicer than a UK bothy, because you do get catering. You know, they're dorm rooms. There were 16 in mine. That's two sets of bunk beds opposite each other with four mattresses along on each side. The food in the evening, very plentiful. It's pretty basic. You know, I had a bolognese and polenta and, you know, vegetable soup and a, you know, cheese course, Tom de Savoie, I should think. And it's basic, but it's beautiful. You know, I think regular listeners will know I've been to quite a few refuges in winter and in summer, and I just can't recommend it enough. And, you know, the next morning I got up and I just did a short walk for about 15 minutes. And I said, you're on the edge of the Vanoise National Park. And I went to go and see, there's a little museum there for the original refuge for that area, for people who actually wanted to climb Mont Pourri. I had a look around that, and that was kind of interesting for the history. And then I kind of noticed on the screen a bit of a movement, and I saw a Bouquetin. I was like, oh, that's pretty exciting. You know, you don't often get yet to see Bouquetin, which are those kind of like big mountain goats. You probably, you know, listeners might have seen the smaller ones, the chamois. You can see them more in winter. But then I saw another, and then another, and then another. And there's like this, well, I'm going to like a massive herd, probably a dozen Bouquetin. I just sat there and watched them, and it was, you know, really, really exciting for me. So, yeah, I recommend it. You know, the Alps in summer in general, take yourself into the national park, like there, stay in a refuge and connect. Right. Now, it will come no surprise to regular listeners, I travelled to Les Arcs by train. In fact, 25% of all of their visitors to Les Arcs come by train. And the tourist office told me that compares to a national average of 10%. And that is not by accident. They have the funicular railway from Bourg-Saint-Maurice, which Jen mentioned earlier. They have a real focus on sustainability, and it's something I have covered before. The only ski resort in Europe, I think, with B Corp accreditation. You can find out more about that in episode 195. But they're also one of the 11 resorts to have two flocons verts. And if your French isn't up to scratch, that's a green snowflake. And one of the reasons I wanted to ask Claire along today is, you know, I've referred to flocons verts and written about flocons verts several times, but I don't think perhaps British listeners understand what that means. So your organization, Claire, is called Mountain Riders. I wondered if you could just tell us a little bit about who Mountain Riders are.
Sure. Mountain Riders is a nonprofit organization. We were founded in 2001. We have more than 20 years of working with mountain areas. It started up with three friends who wanted to organize a cleanup day on a ski slope. And so it was sort of a pendant of a Surf Rider Foundation that did cleanup days on beaches. And so Mountain Riders was born in that spirit of friendship and cleaning pollution. And but today the organization has grown a lot. There are 20 employees at the moment. And we offer many resources in terms of education and also in decision making. What we try to do is enable ski resorts, but that includes mairies and Office du Tourisme, all of the stakeholders of the resorts, to sit at a table together and think about the future. And so what we do is provide resources in terms of a frame of reference, that's the flocons verts, but also in terms of tools. So how can you speak to each other? How can you make better decisions? How can you invite the inhabitants, the locals, all of the people that have something to say about the future of your territory? How can you invite them at the same table? And how can you discuss and make decisions that are enlightened, sustainable, agreed upon?
So I had a look at the Mountain Riders website a little bit earlier on, and you know, the strut line, if you want to call it that, is Ensemble pour les montagnes, meaning together for the mountains. And I can understand that's what you're explaining there. So let's specifically look at the flocons verts then. You know, I mentioned that Les Arcs are one of the 11 resorts that have got two flocons verts. There's a number of other resorts that have got one flocons verts. So what is that, and how do resorts gain that accreditation?
The green flake, the flocons verts, is a label, but it's a process. So for the ski resorts to get the label, they have to go through a process. It's not only checking on criteria. It's more of how they are going to follow process with workshops locally. They have to organize workshops. They have to attend webinars and the network meetings that we have. So basically, they have to commit to a whole process. That's for 1 year and a half.
What are the criteria that they have to meet?
All of the resorts that go through the process, if they commit to an action plan that has been decided collectively, they get the first green flake, the flocons verts. But to have the second, they have to meet 50% of the requirements. Whereas to have the first one, they have to meet only 25% of the requirements. But if you want the second, it's more challenging. And nobody has three flocons verts, which is the level that we aim to challenge resorts at.
We're talking about standards of sustainability here, aren't we?
Yes.
The point of the Flocon Vert is to enable skiers and snowboarders who want to, let's say, make a difference when they go skiing, to be able to choose resorts that have higher sustainability standards than others.
Yes.
And also, you mentioned about, you know, it can take 18 months. To be able to keep those Flocon Vert, resorts need to reapply, don't they? How long does that accreditation last for?
The accreditation lasts for 3 years, and then they have to go through the whole process again.
So it's a continual process. And the Flocon Vert is one of the main projects from Mountain Riders, but there's also the Montagne Zéro Déchet project. Could you explain a little bit about that?
Sure. So originally, our association organized events, cleanup days. We realized that it was not enough because every year we collected the same amount of waste. So we had to tackle the problem at the source.
Jen, you mentioned to me before in the green room that sometimes you and your family do that end of season cleanup as well.
Yeah, we do. It's happened 3 times now. Started in 2003 here, and I've done it each year with my children, and every year we pick up with, I think, over 300 volunteers at different locations through Le Plan, over a ton of rubbish, which is incredible. But I also wish it didn't have to happen. Like Claire said, it's good, but it's not enough because it's taking it back to the source of where all that rubbish is coming from. And one of the really great things that the Mountain Riders Collection do with the local communities is, as all the rubbish is collected, you bring your sack of rubbish that you've collected back to the meeting point of whichever area you're in, and everything is emptied onto a big open space and sorted so that they can classify the different types of rubbish that are being found: cigarette butts, ski material, plastic, food wrappings, etc., etc., and to see where that rubbish is really coming from, and then how can that be addressed further up the chain, as it were. And what I found really interesting this year when we did the cleanup day in June was there were a lot less cigarette butts, for example. So think, great, oh, less smoking on the mountain. That's really good news. But there are a lot more vapes and things like that. So a lot of the rubbish is kind of same, but then you see some of these changes coming through as well, which is quite interesting. But it is a really excellent initiative that happens every year. And it's good to see the children and the local community getting involved in it.
One of the things you mentioned there, Claire, is actually addressing the source. You know, if the amount of rubbish that's collected doesn't go down, then that doesn't really help at all. And I think, you know, in Les Arts, you know, one of the commitments they've made is to reduce single-use plastic. And that's, you know, a key part of it. The race I'm doing next week in Chamonix is one of the UTMB races, the OCC. And I'm hoping to interview someone from their sustainability team there, because they have recently... they've been paying attention and listening, and they have introduced a lot of policies. So, you know, unlike most, I guess, running races, there won't be any plastic water bottles handed out to people. You've got to take your own cup along with you. You've got to take your own utensils with you if you want to be, you know, eating food at any of the aid stations along the way. They're also carbonating their own drinks. So there's no like Coca-Cola bottles or anything like this. I think I read it's going to save 26,000 bottles, because it's, you know, it's a huge event. So that will be really interesting. Hopefully I can bring an interview from that into one of the later podcasts. That's great, Claire. Thank you very much for that. I'm going to put links to all of those things into the show notes. I'll also put a map, Jen, of the new Roche de Millau lift in there as well, so people can understand that dogleg that you're talking about there. We're just going to move to the close now. I always enjoy listener feedback. I love to hear what you think about the show. You can leave me a comment on Spotify, Instagram, or Facebook. Our handle is @SkiPodcast, or you can drop me an email to theskipodcast@gmail.com. If you haven't listened to episode 252 yet, I strongly recommend you do. It is the story of Bladen Lines, and in my opinion, it's the best episode I've ever produced. And based on your feedback, you agree. You know, normally around this time of the podcast, I read out some of your comments, but they were just too many from this episode. So instead, I'd just like to thank all of the following for their kind words about the podcast. And they are Nicola Anderson, Debbie Marshall, Jilly Hooper, Nico Stanford, Victoria Clay, Kirsten Nicol, Matt Hayes, Leslie Glass, Fiona Pankhurst, Colin Barnett, Craig Mayhew, Giles Helbert, Diane Palumbo, Jana Yellowspound, Martin Carver, Alex Irwin, Andrew Brannan, Michael Greenland, James Buist, and from Snowheads, Ski Pow and Kenzie. And perhaps of them all, I was most touched to receive this message from George Lines, who is the son of co-founder Mark Lines. He tragically died in a car accident in 1990. And he said, very much enjoyed this podcast, Ian. I still ski each year in my dad's parrot onesie and regularly get pulled over by people keen to share their fond Blade and Lines memories. A couple of years ago in Val d'Isère, one group told me that they are all friends because their parents met doing seasons with Blade and Lines, and they still all ski together now. You and your contributors captured that sense of community so well. So thank you for that, George. And I was glad to be able to help give you those memories. And if you haven't listened to that podcast, I strongly recommend it. There are actually 268 episodes of the podcast now to catch up with, and 119 of those were listened to in the last week, which is great news because it means Ski Podcast is helping keep you up with your ski fix over the summer. If you've enjoyed this episode, just go to theskipodcast.com, have a search around the tags and categories, and you're bound to find something of interest to listen to as well. In the last week, just over half of our listeners were in the UK, about 15% in the States, and everyone else spread as far and wide across the planet as Botswana, Peru, and Libya. You can follow me at Skipedia and the podcast at Ski Podcast. You can also follow us on WhatsApp for exclusive material released ahead of the podcast. Look in the show notes for that link. And if you enjoyed this episode and like to help us, there are three things you can do. You can follow us or subscribe so you never miss an episode. You can give us a review on Apple Podcasts or leave a comment on Spotify. Both of those two things will help other listeners to find us. And you can book your ski hire at insportrent.com using the code SKIPODCAST. But for now, I would like to thank my guest today. Jen, thank you very much.
No, thank you, Ian. It's been an absolute pleasure to be back.
And Claire, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
And finally, listener, thank you for joining us wherever in the world you're listening right now. And until next time, goodbye.